This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the author of a new book tells us how the lines between politics and entertainment have gotten blurry and how that's changed campaigns and candidates. Now, Thanksgiving and other upcoming winter holidays can mean seeing friends and family you may not have seen for a while. Those interactions may come with mixed emotions, especially given divisions we saw play out around the country and around Wisconsin in the recent midterm elections. There's a good chance for people, maybe you included, to feel some anger at some point during the festivities. It may have felt like there was a lot of anger out there in 2022. Our next guest is a Wisconsin psychologist who studies anger and what we do with it, for better or worse. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you get that feeling that we Americans are angrier and angrier over the course of the years lately? Do you see it more in your own life, in your own personal interactions, in person, or maybe online? Have you found ways to take anger and do something positive with it? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Ryan Martin is a professor of psychology and associate dean of the College of Arts, Humanities, and Social Sciences at UW-Green Bay. He's the author of the book, Why We Get Mad, How to Use Your Anger for Positive Change. Ryan, welcome back to Central Time.
You bet. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I don't know if there's an official anger-ometer, but you know, there's this feeling that we're getting mad. We're getting angrier in the U.S. Over the years. Do you think there's anything to that?
I do, and I will be the first to admit I wish there was an anger-ometer. it'd be great if we had that kind of information. But in the absence of that, we've got to do what we can with the data we have. And you know, if we look to things like instances of road rage, which seem to be on the increase, instances of road rage shootings, which seem to be on the increase. If we look at reports from service providers who talk about anger toward them and hostility toward them being on the increase. Even if we look at things like school fights, or at least reports of school fights, which at least last year were on the increase, we see lots of evidence that there seems to be a problem right now.
How much of that do you think is pandemic related? There's a lot of frustration and uncertainty and maybe fear. Is that spilling over into some of those manifestations you just listed?
Yeah, I really think it is. I think that's a big piece of it. I think it has both a direct and indirect consequence or impact. I think the direct piece is that there's a lot of frustration over the pandemic specifically, not just back when we were sort of in the thick of it, but still there are people who don't like the way it was handled, who continue to not like the way it was handled. I think that is driving some of the anger people are feeling. But I also think there's a much more, as you mentioned, a more indirect implication here, that it raised stress levels for people. It added to uncertainty. It added to economic difficulties for people in ways. And all of those things, which are not little things at all of those things, I think, have a tendency to put people on edge in ways that exacerbate their anger when they experience a provocation.
Okay, and then there's politics. And politics has always had the, you know, potential to divide people and make people angry at one another. We're in a pretty polarized, divided time right now where people kind of identify with their political team and against the other political team. Is that a driver, as you see it, of anger lately?
Yeah, I absolutely think it is. And I think it also ends up manifesting itself in lots of ways. I think we see everything you talked about of people identify with a particular party or a particular candidate, and then either, you know, when other people say bad things about that candidate, they react. When that candidate struggles, they react. I think all of that is playing itself out. I also think, though, that there's a piece of it that, as you said, we're really increasingly polarized. And part of what that means is that you have almost like a real-time indicator of who in the world feel, or who at least in the state or the country feels the way you do about something. And that can be really isolating to people. And it can be really sort of shocking to people to sort of feel like, wow, the world doesn't care about the same things as me. And that I think makes people feel lonely or surprised, and they've lost trust for the fellow people in their community.
Talking to Ryan Martin, psychology professor at UW Green Bay, author of the book Why We Get Mad, How to Use Your Anger for Positive Change. We're talking about anger in the United States in the year 2022. More of it. It feels that way often, even if we can't quite measure that. Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you see it in your workplace, in your interactions with others in person or online? Have you found ways in your life to channel your anger, to say, hey, something's bugging me, and do something good with it instead of something bad with it? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Ryan, we've talked a lot in the past. A big message you have is that anger doesn't have to be a bad thing. We're going to get to the positive uses in a bit, but we know that there are negative outcomes. You mentioned, you know, a highway shooting. Nothing good about that. Snapping at someone in person or starting an online argument. What are some of the things that may trigger those negative outcomes of anger?
Yeah, I mean, there are a host of negative consequences that come from anger, probably more so than people even realize. I mean, there's physical fights, there's verbal fights, there's online fights, there's physical health problems, damaged relationships, all sorts of things, including one that I think often goes unnoticed. And those are some other negative emotions that can oftentimes stem from anger, meaning I get angry, I do something I regret, and then I feel sad or guilty or scared or anxious or all these other things. And I think a lot of the times those outcomes are, you know, they're triggered by the same sorts of things that the positive outcomes can be, right? There's a provocation, and then we respond to that provocation by interpreting it somehow and then acting on that interpretation. A big piece of it, though, is, so what have we learned, and how did we learn to express our anger when we were growing up? How did we learn to deal with it in those moments? And if we learned potentially maladaptive expression styles, we're going to use those in ways that lead to a lot of these negative outcomes. So if I learn to yell and scream, well, then that's the thing I do when I'm provoked, and then that might lead to some of these potentially negative outcomes, like damaged relationships, or even the sort of guilt and sadness that comes later on.
How about, you know, something that might be a baseline generator of anger for us versus the thing that triggers it? So maybe I'm generally angry about something, and that social media post or the person sort of cutting me off in traffic gets that disproportionate response. How do we start to untangle those in our minds?
Yeah, really great question. That's the piece we haven't talked about so much yet, is that we've got this sort of undercurrent that I would just say our mood state, but defining mood broadly at any given time. So how stressed I am, how tired I am, how hungry I am, how angry I am, you know, and that I'm carrying this around with me. And then those little stressors that we hit, you know, the person who kind of cuts us off or being slowed down by someone, or getting an email that feels a little bit hostile from a coworker, all of those things, you know, they feel like much bigger things than they might actually be, because we're carrying all this weight around with us. And so the little thing quickly becomes a big thing based on our current mood state.
Let's talk about some coping mechanisms for a couple different scenarios. First, if our response to anger is that impulsive reaction, whether it's yelling or violence or something else that we probably know is negative, how do we start to tackle it? How do we train ourselves not to have to do that impulsive thing in the moment?
We use the perfect word there, and it's how do we train ourselves, because it takes practice like anything else. You know, we spend a lifetime developing our current expression approaches, and so it takes time to figure out how to undo those, and it takes practice. There's really two things I would suggest kind of right out of the gate. One of those is to actually start to, when you're not angry, in those moments when you're sort of at peace, to take time and reflect on how you want to handle those situations when they come up. If we go in through life saying and telling ourselves that we want to have an identity as someone who is calm, someone who can stay collected in those moments, someone who can control themselves, it is a big piece of the puzzle. It's we're making that decision in advance of the frustrating thing. the next piece, though, is to reflect afterwards. And this is a part that I think can be really hard for people is after they've had that kind of outburst, after they've done something that they regret, to reflect back on it and to take time to actually sort of pay attention to how you reacted, to talk yourself through how you wish you would have handled it. Really, what we're trying to do is figure out, we've got to build or identify and find a way to pause in the moment. And that can be really difficult for people to figure out in the moment. So being able to reflect on it later gives you time to sort of practice it in your mind, practice, okay, so how do I do this? How do I, next time I am encountered by some provocation, how do I stop myself from losing my cool? It's a little bit like athletes watching game tape, right? You know, it's about trying to figure out, okay, so what do I do next time?
Let's take this to the Thanksgiving table. And I think we've had this conversation before holidays before. Ryan, we know me and a cousin, whatever, or sibling or whatever, by and large, we love each other, but we know how to push each other's buttons. We've got some good material to work with, say, coming out of the midterm elections. How do we make sure we don't spiral into something?
Yeah, I think one of the first things I would say is, you know, figure out now. We're a couple days away. Figure out now what your goals are for that for the holiday. You know, do you want to get through this without an altercation? And if you do, then make that your priority. And I think that's fundamentally different than if your priority is to say, well, I want to score some points, right? You know, that going into it with, okay, I want to get through this. I want to still get along afterwards. So I'm going to make the relationship the priority. It becomes a very different interaction. A couple different ways to handle it, either in the moment or in advance. I mean, depending on the relationship, I think you can actually reach out in advance and say to the person, you know what, I want this to be a fun, relaxing day. I really want to make sure we don't talk about politics or any of those provocations. Can we leave that off the table for this get together and see how that goes? Another possibility is just to kind of figure out, maybe you talk to your partner or you talk to someone else and say, hey, let's have an out if the conversation starts going that way. How can we intentionally, you know, deflect in those moments? Maybe there's a phrase you can say to try and get out of that conversation if it's going a way you don't want it to go.
We're talking about anger, the year in anger, and getting ready for the holidays with Ryan Martin, professor of psychology at UW Green Bay, author of the book Why We Get Mad. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Where did you see, hear, or feel anger in 2022? Did you see a lot of it around the midterm elections? Do you dread what I was just talking about, that conflict at Thanksgiving or other holidays? Have you found ways to work around that with a family member or other loved one you disagree with but want to get along with? Call in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your experiences, your questions. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about anger in the year 2022. Ryan Martin stays with us, professor of psychology at UW Green Bay, author of the book Why We Get Mad, How to Use Your Anger for Positive Change. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, your observations at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Steve is on the line with us now in Stoughton. Steve, hi. Are you there, Steve? Not hearing you, Steve, if you're talking. I got a note about Steve's question, though. Steve wonders if there's any correlation between testosterone and anger. If so, should we be teaching and learning more about it? Ryan, what do we know?
Yeah, this is a big, tough question and probably too much to answer in just a few minutes here. But I can tell you, historically, people have really pointed to links between testosterone and aggression specifically. And finding there being a lot of research connecting these things. When I say aggression, I mean the intent to hurt someone. So a little bit different from anger, but related. What we've seen, though, more recently is that a lot of that research was done using animals and didn't necessarily apply to human beings. So we see that testosterone predicts aggression, but only specific types of aggression, things related to like social hierarchy seeking and things like that. To connect it back to anger a little bit, more recent research has really looked at, and largely through testosterone replacement therapies and things like that, and the invention of that, has looked at the ability, or looked more specifically at anger, and found that indeed there does seem to be a bit of a link there, being able to see that higher instances of testosterone do predict anger. It's not the only thing that matters, but it's something that does seem to play a role.
Thanks for sending that question along, Steve. We also heard from Austin Lafarge, who couldn't stay on the line, wanted to ask about anger as an expression of other unresolved emotions or anxiety, and getting those under control first can help with anger management.
Yeah, I love the way this person asked this question, because it's very different from how I usually hear it, which is it true that anger is a secondary emotion, which is a very common claim? And I think the answer is that anger can be a secondary emotion, but it isn't always. So does it emerge from other negative feeling states like sadness or anxiety or guilt or jealousy or other sort of unresolved feeling states? It absolutely can, including some things we wouldn't necessarily consider emotions, like just feeling hurt, which can reveal itself in sadness or, frankly, can reveal itself in some anger. I do think it's worth noting, though, is that sometimes when we talk about anger being secondary, and this caller definitely didn't do that, but sometimes when we refer to it as being secondary, I think it ends up minimizing some very real angry feelings that are justified. And we need to acknowledge that anger is something that can be just the primary thing that a person is feeling. And I think that's important.
Talking to Ryan Martin from UW Green Bay, expert there on the psychology of anger. Still time for your calls on the topic at 800-642-1234. Ryan, let's talk about some of the positive, constructive uses of anger. Let's get back to the world of politics now. If someone's unhappy with one of the results from this year's election, and it was a mixed bag, somebody's probably angry about something, or that a particular issue isn't getting the attention they think it deserves in the political world, what are some constructive ways they can channel that feeling of anger?
Yeah, I'm really glad you asked, because it's really important for people to know that anger isn't inherently negative. It's frankly one of the ways that your brain alerts you to injustice or goal blocking or having been wronged and things like that. And so it can be a good thing depending on what we do with it. And when it comes to the what we do with it, we've seen countless examples of people channeling their anger into those positive outcomes, whether it is, I mean, frankly, voting out of anger is one of those potentially positive ways to channel your anger. So is protesting. So are letters to the editor. So is donating money to particular candidates. All of those are ways that people can channel their anger into something, something good and positive. People use it to create art. They use it, They channel it into music and writing, problem solving. There's all sorts of good things. Even good assertive communication can be a way of channeling that anger into something positive. That, of course, I mean, assertive communication might, you know, offend people, but it's different than the kind of aggression that we see oftentimes really harming people.
So assertive communication isn't me yelling at someone. I'm guessing it's me laying out why their actions have made me angry.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. And thank you for that clarification. It's a way of sort of voicing your perspective on something in a way that is that might be different from the person you're talking with, but it isn't necessarily violating their rights in any way.
Now, a resource you pointed toward us, and you're quoted here heavily, a new mental health resource website called WonderMind. And I understand you're a fan of this. What do you like about it?
Yeah, I'm really excited about WonderMind. This is a resource that just came up recently. It's Selena Gomez and some others have put together this mental health resource. A big piece of what I like is the simplicity with which it's all organized and how easy it is to find a lot of great resources. So there's the opportunity to, there's a button right on the homepage that says filter by feels and allows you to click on it and then go and look at, okay, I want to learn more about happiness or sadness or envy or anger in this case. And then there's just a handful of articles there related to those specific topics. So it's a really valuable mental health resource that I'm super excited to have been very, to have been involved in.
Is there anything else apart from this WonderMind resource making you feel optimistic about anger and the way we deal with it as we wrap up this kind of wild couple of years?
Yeah, there are some things. I see it through my experiences on social media. And this is going to sound odd to people, perhaps, but I see a generation younger than me that is really reflective about their feelings, a generation that really does care about their feelings, the feelings of others, that is sort of aware of mental health in all sorts of positive ways. And I think those are things that I feel optimistic for. I think that what I would call emotional literacy does seem to be on the rise, and that's a good thing.
And leave us with a bit of advice, Ryan, a quick tip to not go with that initial negative response when we get angry.
Yeah, it goes back to something I said for kind of how to handle Thanksgiving mm-hmm. dinner. Figure out your goals. Think about what you really want in this situation. Is it to get revenge? Is it to get to work safely? Is it to preserve a relationship? Start there, and that'll help you stay calm in those difficult moments.
Ryan, thanks for joining us again today.
Thank you so much for having me. Always a pleasure.
That's Ryan Martin, professor of psychology and associate dean of the College of Arts, Humanities, and Social Sciences at UW-Green Bay. We talked with him about anger in 2022, how to recognize and manage anger in ourselves and others, and why, as he said, anger doesn't have to be a negative emotion. It can motivate positive action. You can read more. That website we mentioned is called WonderMind. We'll put up a link at the Central Time website, wpr.org/Central Time. You can see Ryan and many other mental health experts quoted there on anger and a wide variety of other topics. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, get some advice on protecting your health during the holiday travel season. A doctor is going to join the show with advice on COVID, safety, and more. You can join in with your questions right now. Email ideas@wpr.org. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. A classic Thanksgiving activity, at least in my family, is to watch some or all of the National Dog Show on Thanksgiving Day. We'll have to wait until Thursday to see who wins in each category and best in show, but we do have some dog winners already. The top names for dogs in 2022. This comes from a pet insurance company called Trupanion. Technically, it's the top dog names for dogs insured by that company. Here's their top 10 list, counting down from 10 to 1. Number 10, dog name Max. 9, Teddy. 8, Bailey. Number 7 is Cooper. 6, Lucy. 5, Milo. 4 is Daisy. Top 3, Bella. Number 2, Charlie. And the number 1 dog name, Luna. Bonus, the top 3 breeds are Labrador Retriever, Golden Doodle, and Golden Retriever. I say they're all winners. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, more Americans from across all age groups are living under one roof. In fact, since the 1970s, multi-generational living has doubled. Finances and family are two key drivers. Find out more and hear stories from listeners today at 6 on 1A+. Now, the political landscape has shifted in recent years. Some of the rules of modern politics may be different than they were even a decade ago. Our next guest points to former President Trump as an example of how politicians and parties function in our current media landscape and says that a new mixture of politics and entertainment extends beyond any one candidate. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen the world of politics change in recent years? Do you see politicians' image and perception becoming more important than their actual politics and policies? Are there candidates you've seen reverse that trend, take a more old-school approach? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. David Schultz is a professor of political science at Hamline University, professor of law at the University of Minnesota. He's co-author of the new book, Trumpism, American Politics in the Age of Politainment. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me again. It's always a pleasure.
Let's tackle this concept of politainment, politics and entertainment. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's interesting. It's a term that a student of mine about 25 years came up with when Jesse Ventura was elected governor in Minnesota. And she at one point said to me that, you know, he's kind of like a combination of a politician and an entertainer at the same time. And she coined the word polytainer, and we eventually did some writing on it to say, well, there's really a new era of politics now. It's about how certain candidates for office, we call polytainers, really sort of feed off of let's say network news or let's say the social media, and they kind of are engaged in a symbolic, almost parasitic relationship about how now candidates who are good in terms of entertainment venues become very successful in campaigns, and of how oftentimes candidates now to reach people go out onto what? Onto entertainment platforms to reach people and not just appear on news, and how news increasingly, in order to be able to become profitable to attrain visitors, listeners, oftentimes uses entertainment venues or techniques to reach people. And so what we really decided is that what we're really looking at is Donald Trump is the most recent incarnation of how politicians, entertainment, and politics have really converged together.
And the title of the book is Trumpism. You say Donald Trump isn't the only person doing these things, but he mastered it in a way that matched up with the media landscape at the time. What are some of the things you saw him doing that that exemplified politainment, at least as it currently exists?
Well, let's think about Donald Trump before he even ran for president of the United States. Now, in a deeper sense, he was playing the New York media scene for many years. But what was it? For 15 years, he was the host of The Apprentice. He cultivated an image. He cultivated a brand. You know, so we had, you know, the Trump Towers, the Trump Estate, but Trump Wines, Trump Steaks. I'm trying to think of all the other kind of Trump things. But really what he did very successfully was to create a brand on television about who he was and his persona. And even when he declared for his presidency, you know, this was kind of a made-for-TV event. And to a large extent, we have studies that pointed out that in 2016, when he first ran, that the commercial media found that by covering him, they would get enormous numbers of viewership. And so Trump found that by appealing to the media, the skills that he honed would get him media attention. The media found that by covering him, that would generate viewers, which translates into dollars. And so they really sort of came together. And then also, I think where Trump was brilliant was in the sense of understanding how to master social media in terms of Twitter. And as president, he would start off every day early in the morning, let's say, send out two or three tweets that would then set the political and news agenda for the rest of the day. So he really understood ways of how to further his image, to help him politically, but at the same time, it served the interests of let's say mainstream media by giving them easy news stories to cover. So in some sense, they really were, again, kind of a relationship built for one another.
Yeah, there's this concept called earned media in the PR world, yeah. Meaning I've gotten my person or my product or my company in the news without paying for an advertisement. And whatever people think about the politics of Donald Trump, he got a lot of that earned media on CNN in particular, or by, as you said, tweeting and getting coverage of tweets. I don't think I've seen anything else like that in politics.
You're absolutely correct. I mean, the estimates I've seen were somewhere in the area of about $2.6 billion, as in the B, billion dollars in 2016 that he got in terms of earned media. And he understood it's not just, you know, traditional news. It was going to be in, let us say, non-traditional sources, because as we know, not everybody's watching the news. Not everybody is reading a newspaper. People are going to social media. They're going to, and I talk about this in my book, take us back 20 years ago, you know, to 2020, actually the 2000 election. The nighttime talk shows, you know, Letterman, Leno, places like that were the place to go for coverage. Or think about it, if I work backwards in time, how did Bill Clinton in 1992 launch his really his presidential campaign? Appearing on Arsenio Hall, and he played the saxophone. So we have this long legacy of where candidates understood how to go to let's say, pop culture venues to be able to attract attention. But really Trump, part of what the book is about, is how Trump understood and mastered this very effectively.
Talking to David Schultz from Hamline University and the University of Minnesota, co-author of the new book, Trumpism, American Politics in the Age of Politainment, Blurring the Lines Between Politics and Entertainment, Cultivating Images, and Changing the Rules of Politics. You could join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Do you have a recent or distant example of a major political candidate crossing the lines, harnessing the power of entertainment, ably or less so? Or do you have a question for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. David, at the heart of this, I think, is a changing media landscape. Once upon a time, you know, there were big, serious newspapers and just a few networks. And if I'm a politician and I talk about my policies, they probably cover it. Now there's so many different outlets, so much competition for our eyes and ears. Is this cultivation of an image, this politainment, what it takes to cut through the noise and get out there?
I think it is, in part, because in a fragmented media market, you've got to find all kinds of different places to be able to advertise. But additionally, also think about it here, that so I think effectively cutting through some of the noise, but also what I try to talk about in the book here is that even though we need to be thinking about the changing political landscape that the new media markets and fragmentation, you know, portend, I still try to discuss in the book, there's some basic essentials that never go away. And part of the book is talking about Trumpism, about how there are other candidates who are doing this, about sort of the polytainment landscape. But as you go through the book here, I basically discuss sort of the basic 10 rules of politics, and they're the fundamentals for winning campaigns. So, for example, my most important rule of politics, and I try to write these with pop culture references, is to say that what politics is like is like selling beer. At the end of the day, politics is still about having a clear message, a narrative, a story to tell. And if you think about, for example, Donald Trump's message, from back 6 years ago, whether you liked it or not, it's a different story entirely. It was what? Make America great again. He had a story. He had a message. And what I try to unfold in the book is these 10 different rules about appealing to your base, having a message, all about thinking about fact versus fiction, reality in terms of how you craft those messages. And so what I try to do is to say that what Trump really captures in some ways is both this sort of new reality of communications, but at the same time grafts it onto some real basic rules about how you really do winning campaigns. And the whole art of the book here, it's not written for political scientists. This is written for the general public, is to say, let's take what we've learned about political science, what we've learned about real campaigns, and how do we now explain this to real people? And my co-author, Avery Gaylor, was a high school student, and I said to her, go help me come find with me pop culture references that appeal to your generation also. So what we're really trying to think about is how do we appeal to a new generation of voters? How do we run winning campaigns in this new political environment?
We're talking to political science and law professor David Schultz about his new book, Trumpism, American Politics in the Age of Politainment. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think politics have become too much about emotions and entertainment? And What do you think it takes to win a campaign? Big ads that earned media, capturing the media's eye through entertainment type statements? Or is there a lot of old school stuff that still applies? Call 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to David Schultz about his new book, Trumpism, American Politics in the Age of Politainment. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Erica is with us in Lake Tomahawk. Erica, hi.
Well, hi there. You were talking about politainment, and I think two fine examples are Adolf Hitler and Joe McCarthy. Adolf Hitler discredited the media. And he was he was the whole show, and so was Joe McCarthy. He had nothing to not a leg to stand on politically, but or even factually. But by God, he got in the news.
Thanks for the call, David. What do you think? Older examples?
I think there are older examples. I think Joe McCarthy is a great one. Again, my focus is on American politics, but clearly there's no question that Hitler understood how to, you know, manipulate the media, manipulate communication technologies. He understood very effectively, you know, how to play upon, and I talk about this in my book too, about how to play upon the emotions of people very, very well. The way I sort of trace it out here is that really sort of the road to politainment. I hadn't thought about Joe McCarthy. I thought about Dwight Eisenhower initially, you know, the first presidential candidate to run political advertising, or about how John Kennedy was really sort of the first made-for-TV president, or how in 1968, I think it was, Richard Nixon appears on the NBC show Laugh-In, understanding how to appeal to, again, pop culture references to help yourself. Or I was thinking of another Midwestern candidate at this point. I'm forgetting his name now. Remember the old show Love Boat? And there was, I think, Fred Grandy, who played Gopher
on Love Boat. Yeah.
Yeah. He goes on to become a member of Congress, or Sonny Bono becomes a member of Congress using their persona. And the reason why I use the word persona is that they become manufactured candidates. It's not a real person. It's the persona they're running. Donald Trump ran as a persona, not as who he was. And that gets into one of the other themes of the book, where polytainment is about a world where what? Fact and fiction blur. And it's about setting up a world where you don't have to run on truth. You can run on image. You can run on really images and symbols that appeal to people.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Sid joins us now in Milwaukee. Sid, hi.
Hey, I would say that the stakes, like this, what hangs in the balance is far greater right now in terms of politics than before because of the sheer religious and ethnic diversity in the USA. I mean, we're kind of on the edge of where, like, people that want to continue the only thing the USA had in common from sea to shining sea was white supremacy. So that's taking away a huge portion of, like, the de facto pre-1960s culture. And as we get extremely ethnically diverse, it's essentially just a war between those that want to continue the traditional, quote unquote, America, and it becoming, you know, a new thing where that's not going to be the culture and it'll balkanize. I don't see a way out.
Sid, thanks for the call. How do you see a more diverse culture, David, affecting the way political campaigns work?
It certainly challenges them in a variety of ways, because first it's going to mean perhaps finding all the different venues to reach different populations. It's also going to mean having to refine your strategies in terms of messaging. You know, for many years, I taught in a school of business, and in that school of business, we talked all about corporate communications. And there used to be this old joke that said, for advertising and messaging, I know half of my advertising is a waste. I just don't know which half is a waste at this point. And what I'm getting at here, if we think about, and this is part of what polytainment is about, if we think about candidates as being, and campaigns as being businesses and products to be sold, how do we market a candidate like a Donald Trump? How do we message him? And the plurality our growing ethnic diversity in this country only creates more of a challenge in terms of figuring out how to use more multimedia strategies to be able to reach people and to appeal to different groups with different messages. And again, what Trump was good at doing was identifying a core base of people, a core base that's with him. Remember, he once said, what was it? I could take out a gun on Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and they wouldn't abandon me or something. He understood his core base, how to work with them and how to message to them. And then he also understood, again, how to get that earned media time, how to message in ways like Make America Great Again, to say something without saying anything.
We are talking to David Schultz. His new book is Trumpism, American Politics in the Age of Politainment. Let's bring on another caller. Kevin is with us in Janesville. Kevin, hi.
Hi. Say, I totally get the point the author's trying to make with the politainment. I see it. But ultimately, isn't this just empty calories of potato chips? And we're still longing for something more sustaining and fulfilling, and that the latest flash in the pan is just going to go and the next bright, shiny bauble gets our attention and political careers are gone. And here we are suffering because of it.
Kevin,
thank you.
Thanks for the call. What do you think, David?
I think the caller is exactly right, that we are chasing one shiny ball to the next. It's almost like that whatever's trendy today really sort of will capture our attention and sell. It sells a candidate. It sells an image and so forth. And that's exactly the whole point here, is that if the goal is for a candidate to capture our attention in a noisy world, conversely, if it's the goal of for-profit media to be able to figure out ways of attracting viewers, the marriage comes together to figure out what's the shiny object that we talk about today that will appeal to both helping the candidate and appeal to selling airtime, selling advertising, et cetera, et cetera. And the depressing part about it, I think the caller is exactly correct in this, is the sense that it's not about substantive public policy. It's not about saying, let's actually accomplish or do something. It's, I think I point out at one point, it's about image is everything, reality is nothing. Say that you're making America great again, or say that we're doing certain types of things. That may be more important than really actually doing things. I mean, again, going back, and the focus is on Trump here, you know, is that Trump in so many ways represented, for example, the antithesis of let's say what evangelical Christians supported and what they wanted, yet they supported him because he said the right things. It may be what you say, not what you do.
Thanks for that call. David, getting back to your rules of politics, one thing that struck me here in Wisconsin, post-election on the Republican side of things, there's a fairly heated email thread about why they didn't win the race for governor. And there's the debate, aside saying we put too much money into the high-priced consultants, not enough into the oldest school of politics, people going and knocking on doors and persuading people to go to the polls on our side. You address both sides of that in your rules, and this isn't the first time a campaign has had that post-mortem debate.
You're actually correct here. I want to take us back to 2016 when Hillary Clinton lost the presidential race, and she lost it because, in part, she didn't follow the basic rule of politics. The way I describe it, in Minnesota, she lost the caucuses. She lost the primary in Wisconsin, lost the primary in Michigan. What does she do? She takes the votes for granted, figures that, guess what? Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota, and Pennsylvania have nowhere else to go. In those first three states, she never comes back to campaign during the general election, and she loses two of those three and loses the presidency. And in her closing days of her election, instead of nailing down her base, she goes to places like Arizona and Texas. And what I try to argue is that she violated one of the most fundamental rules of politics, which is the idea of saying what? Mobilize your base, take every campaign, ask for a vote. Don't assume it's yours. And I think partly what we saw in Wisconsin this year is Republicans, you know, violating that. But also at some point, it's the message. They were trying to sell a brand, sell a message, and they were not successful, at least at the gubernatorial level, in terms of doing it. And so a lot of, again, what this book is about is rules that seem to endure. basically, no matter what the communication technologies, what are the basic rules for winning politics?
In our last minute, David, flip things around. A voter is listening. How do they try to see through the images that campaigns are creating?
This comes the tougher one here is in terms of how do they sort through a lot of the stuff here. You know, originally the show was going to be about a piece that I did in a local newspaper saying about my argument against polling during elections. I would start off by saying first, ignore any polls that are out there. Don't pay attention because they're a distraction. Try to figure out ways of going beyond the social media. Read across lots of reputable sources of news. And maybe almost ask the basic question here. If a candidate is promising something too good to be true, it probably is too good to be true.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
My pleasure, and thank you to the listeners.
That's David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University, professor of law at the University of Minnesota, with us today sharing his new book. It's called Trumpism, American Politics in the Age of Politainment. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, former Wisconsin Congressional Representative Reid Ribble joins the show for a look at his Republican Party, the midterm election results, and the future of politics in the state and around the country. And NASA launched the Artemis probe over the weekend, the first in a series of planned moon missions coming after some delays. We'll check out the launch and the future of moon exploration, including a possible return of humans to the lunar surface. That and more. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.